from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio, good morning and welcome to Forum. I'm Judy Campbell, in for Michael Krasny. Leah Sait is a young professional in her 20s. Once, when she sat in the disability section of a bus, one woman was so offended that she yelled at Leah to give up her seat for seniors. But Leah is disabled. She has a disease that affects her joints and leaves her sometimes needing a wheelchair. But most of the time, it's impossible to tell just by looking at her. As part of our In My Experience series, spotlighting the personal stories of Northern California residents, we talk with several people who have physical disabilities that aren't visible to the naked eye. We discuss how these disabilities affect their lives. Living with invisible disabilities, next on Forum. From KQED Public Radio, good morning and welcome to Forum. I'm Judy Campbell, in today for Michael Krasny. Sometimes a disability announces itself to the public. Sometimes someone is in a wheelchair or attached to a device. But for many people with disabilities, nothing shows on the outside. The person may have extremely limited mobility, be in intense pain, or utterly fatigued. But to those around them, their plight goes unnoticed. They may be thought of as lazy or inconsiderate when they take a handicapped seat on a bus or a parking space. It may be harder to get the attention and care they need from medical professionals, and they may face hard decisions during the day, when to disclose your disability at work or with a new friend. This hour, as part of Forum's In My Experience series, which spotlights the personal stories of Northern Californians, we talk with a panel of people with invisible disabilities. In this hour, we'll be focusing on people with mostly physical symptoms. We are planning on a future show on the experiences of those with mental health issues. Joining us to share their stories are Leah Sait, who has Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, which affects her joints and mobility. Thanks for joining.
Thanks for having me.
Jim Vos, who has spinal stenosis and chronic pain.
Thanks for having me as well.
And Ariel, a wrestler who has chronic fatigue syndrome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And by phone, we have Sarah Schaefer, who has Sjogren syndrome. Thanks for joining, Sarah Schaefer. Leah Sait, let's start with you. Can you describe your disability, and first actually describe when you're very young. You are 25 years old, and you first started noticing symptoms when you were 16. Is that right?
Yes. So around when I was 16, I started noticing symptoms. I think I'd had physical symptoms since I first learned to walk. My parents noticed that my gait was off from the beginning. My legs bowed inward. And physicians made it pretty clear that there wasn't any permanent thing they could do to fix that. So nothing was done. I wasn't in any pain. It didn't seem to have any effect up until the time I was in high school. I rode for a crew team. I was a dancer and a swimmer. And within about 2 weeks, I sprained both of my ankles. Hmm. And from that point on, it seemed that my ankles could never be in place.
Describe that. What does that mean, never in place?
Every time I took a step, I wasn't sure if I would complete it without hurting myself. So my ankle would kind of roll out of place. It took a long time for me to find the right word, which is subluxation, which is one step down from a dislocation. The joint doesn't completely come out, but it kind of falls to the side a little bit.
And this happens daily or?
Not quite often? Daily, but okay. Several times a week, definitely. And when I was 16, it was pretty hard. I had to quit all of my sports. I couldn't be active anymore. I found other hobbies, but it definitely changed the end of my high school.
And did you know what was happening to you at this point?
I had no idea. I didn't consider the word disability a word that I could use to identify myself until the end of college.
So did you think this was, did you think other people experienced things like this, or how did you put it into context?
There was a while where I thought that some people maybe just had more energy than I did. I would find myself getting tired before others. If I was out with friends and we were walking around downtown, or if we'd go to a theme park together, I would always need to sit down. I would always need to rest. I wouldn't be able to just keep going with everyone. And sometimes I would make myself keep going just to fit in. And I would wind up exhausted. I'd be pretty much bedridden the next day. I'd have no energy for a couple of days. Mm. And for a while, I just thought that maybe I didn't have the same energy levels as other people. I didn't really ever consider that it could be something physical within me.
So when did that change? Did your condition get worse?
It definitely got worse through the end of high school and all the way through college. It spread from just manifesting in my ankles to my knees, hips, shoulders, back, arms, wrists, everywhere. Things just seemed to kind of pop out every time I would try to move. If I would sit down, my kneecap would slide to the side. Nothing ever seemed stable. And it got to the point that by the end of college, I took my car to campus with me because I couldn't walk the 7 blocks to class.
Now, at this point, it sounds like you probably weren't able to do a lot of things that people around you were able to do.
Absolutely. You know, I'd have to turn down friends that would invite me to go out to explore the city when we were in college. I knew that I would either kind of drag them down, I would have low energy, and I didn't want to, you know, ruin my friends' fun. Mm-hmm. So I would opt out. I wouldn't go.
But all this without knowing why.
Exactly. Up until, I think it was the summer before my senior year of college, I thought about the word disability. I spent the summer in Washington, D.C., and I got to go to the 20th anniversary celebration of the passing of ADA. And that's when I looked around and I thought, these people are like me. I think this is kind of my community. This is a word I can use for myself.
So this is something you came to yourself. It's not something you came through your doctors.
Not at all.
And what was your experience with doctors?
With doctors, I would go in and explain that I had this pain. They would do all kinds of tests on me, blood tests, x-rays, all kinds of things. And nothing ever came back conclusive. They'd say, your x-rays look fine. There's nothing wrong with your bones. You have no blood problems. You don't have this. You don't have that. Nothing seems out of the norm. And so they'd kind of send me off and say, keep living life the best you can. And after years and years of this, I told them I couldn't. I couldn't live life the best I could. So I finally realized that it seemed like the doctors that I was seeing weren't really able to help me. And I'd seen specialists of every kind. So I did some research of my own and found something called hypermobility syndrome, which is basically hyperflexibility. A lot of dancers and gymnasts have it. I took it to a doctor and said, do I have this? The doctor confirmed that I had it, but that still didn't answer where the pain was coming from. Because a lot of, again, dancers and gymnasts have it without the chronic pain, without always hurting themselves, although it's possible. And it wasn't until just a couple of months ago that I found out I have Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, which is an advanced form of hypermobility.
And what impact did that have on you, having a name, a diagnosis?
It was honestly a huge relief. As soon as I had heard the name Ehlers-Danlos and done some research, it seemed that it fit me. Hypermobility didn't seem like enough. I knew I was missing something. I was missing some diagnosis.
And do you feel like the fact that it's not visible, that you look like a very healthy young woman, affected your experience with the medical establishment? I mean, do you think it was harder to get a diagnosis since it was an invisible disability?
Absolutely. You know, again, for years I had doctors telling me that I looked fine and there couldn't be anything wrong with me. And I had a podiatrist confirm that my gait was off, but that really didn't tell me anything. Other than that, doctors said that since all the tests they were doing looked fine and since I looked fine, they couldn't see the pain that I was feeling. So they told me that it probably wasn't as bad as I was thinking it was.
How does it feel when people tell you you look fine?
It gets irksome because I know that people mean it as a compliment, but I think people just sometimes don't know what to say, especially with a chronic disability. I've definitely had people, you know, if I'm having a high pain day, I've had people tell me, I hope you get better soon. And I have to say, that's not how chronic pain works.
Right. And I think it's hard for people to know how to talk to people about situations.
Absolutely. Word choice is tricky. It's something that I try to focus on a lot.
Well, you've had some confrontational experiences, right?
Absolutely. Yes, I have.
Talk about your experience on a munibus.
I was on a munibus a year and a half ago, probably. It had been a long day. I had subluxed my knee that morning. I was coming home from having lunch with a friend downtown, and I took a seat at the front of the bus, and it was near the terminal, so it was pretty empty when I got on. But as the bus kept going, it got busier and busier. It was a Sunday morning, and there were a lot of senior citizens on the bus, older people who might have needed a seat, but I couldn't tell. I know that not all senior citizens need to sit down. Some of them do, but not all of them do. And one woman who was not necessarily considered a senior citizen, but got right in my face and told me that I should give my seat up. That, you know, if you look around, there's some old people on this bus. You should give your seat up. And I just looked at her and I said, actually, I'm disabled. I need to be sitting down right now. And she didn't say a word back to me. She just spat on me.
Wow. And what happened then? How did people react?
I didn't know what to say. I was in shock. Part of me wanted to just get off the bus and cry because it was the worst thing that's ever happened to me. But I think I'm glad I didn't. People were staring. No one said anything to her. No one said anything to me. No one came to my defense. I don't know if anyone on that bus knew what an invisible disability was because, again, to her, I looked fine. But I was kind of on my own at that point, and I didn't say anything for the rest of the ride.
How do you think your experience would be different if you had a visible disability, if people could see what you were going through? And you do occasionally use a wheelchair, so you have a comparison.
I do occasionally, although I've never used it on Muni, so I'm not sure how that would go. But if I had a wheelchair or a cast or crutches or even a visible limp, I think people might have been more sympathetic. Someone might have spoken up, but maybe not. I think I would have expected a little more support in that case and probably would have expected that she wouldn't have come up to me if I was sitting there, you know, with crutches or a cast.
We're talking about invisible disabilities as part of our In My Experience series, profiling the stories of Northern Californians. That's Leah Sate, who has Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, which affects her joints and mobility. Jim Vos, you have spinal stenosis and chronic pain. Tell me, this is all stemming back quite a long time.
About 10 years. Initially, I had headaches. I was at work in afternoons. I'd have headaches that would kick in about 4 o'clock every day. And, you know, after going to a number of doctors about headaches, a typical, you know, take an aspirin or it began there. And then I finally got in after a period of time, got an MRI and they saw some problems with my neck. So I ended up ultimately getting a fusion. And my expectation at that point was that in about 3 months, I'd be right back at work. Worked in Silicon Valley.
Describe this. You didn't just work in Silicon Valley, right? I mean, you were a...
I was a 60-hour a week, typical Silicon Valley guy. I traveled all over the world, had been for 20 years in various positions, kind of going, I describe it as going, you know, 80 miles an hour all the time. I've always been a high achiever. And so after that 3 months, it turned out that my pain started to really manifest itself in different ways. So I started to get lots of back pain, severe back pain. I had some additional MRIs through my doctor. They describe the stenosis as, you know, fairly minor from the MRI perspective, but that didn't account for the degree of pain I had. And it took, it progressively got worse. I never went back to work. The first year I spent literally in severe pain, sat in a chair literally for a year, and there was nothing that anybody could do in terms of treatment for the pain. I ended up going into my doctor and essentially breaking down and saying, I just can't live like this. There's got to be some treatment for this. And they tried a variety of medications and ultimately found something that worked. And that helped with the pain and got it more to a manageable level, at least at some, you know, at some point. But I live with pain every day at various levels. In fact, I'm in the process of moving, and so it's been a strenuous couple of days, even with having movers. And the show's called Invisible Disabilities, and I thought I probably don't qualify for invisible disabilities because if you saw me yesterday, I barely could walk 5 steps. I literally was hunched over. I needed help to get out of a car, and I was just a wreck. So I have days like that. Off and on, where I've just got to lay down, and there's very little I can do about it, even with the medication. So, getting back to kind of the career aspect, I ended up basically going from 80 miles an hour to zero. I had to reconcile the fact I wasn't going to be able to go back to work. I wasn't going to be able to resume my career.
Now, is this something they understood at work? What was the...
Well, I think because I took a leave of absence to kind of give it time to see if it would play out, and you know, it basically didn't seem likely that I'd be able to return. So, you know, I didn't really pursue it actively. I knew that I couldn't continue in the position I had been in, and I, you know, the other aspect of this was financial. You know, without an income. You know, at that time, I was supporting two houses, a vacation home, and a main residence, and so I had a fair amount of savings for my career, and I guess I didn't really think about being disabled or being classified as disabled, and I didn't pursue financial support through the disability program. And finally, after a few years, I said, this is ridiculous. I'm going to go look into it.
And was that difficult? And did you find that it being invisible disability made it worse?
I think the system is fundamentally broken. If you're not somebody who's, say, a day laborer, I think the disability system is really oriented towards that. So a working professional doesn't really fit the mold of somebody who might be disabled. And I had to go through a couple of rounds with the disability system to finally get approval. I had to seek support from an attorney, and the attorney went in and basically within 5 minutes the judge ruled that I was fully disabled. So at least I got some financial assistance at that point.
And in your day-to-day, talk about your day-to-day life now. I mean, you are home and you are raising your daughter.
Yeah, my wife and I had originally planned that she would take time off from work, be a full-time mom. Obviously, those plans changed and I became Mr. Mom. She continued in her career. She's an attorney. And so I ended up raising my daughter, which has been terrific.
Well, and there's a lot involved in raising a kid. And how do you feel you get the understanding and support in the community? I mean, having an invisible disability, does it make do you feel like you're falling short on expectations of what you should be doing?
I went through a struggle in terms of my own identity. I think, like most men, you know, we're defined by our work. Maybe women are a little bit better at having a broader view of the world than most men do, but I struggle with that. I never had pictured myself being kind of Mr. Mom. It was somewhat difficult initially when Olivia, my daughter, was very young, taking her to parks, and I felt like I was invading this space where it was really the woman's domain. I was who's this man in our world kind of feeling. That lessened as time went on.
And are you able to keep up? I mean, the playground can be an active place, even for parents.
I do as much as I can. I volunteer at her school. I'm able to do 2 or 3 hours a week. But honestly, I pick her up from school, prepare a meal for her when we get home. But by about 4:30, I definitely need to lie down. So I think the key thing to understand is that the pain never leaves and it's a matter of severity. So by 4:30 or 5, I'm just spent and really need to find a horizontal position.
Check in. Now we're speaking about invisible disabilities with Jim Vose, who has spinal stenosis and chronic pain. Ariel, wrestler, you have chronic fatigue syndrome. What kind of assumptions do you think people make about you when they see you? And how does that affect you?
Sure. I mean, one of the things, there's so much resonance for me on the panel with both Leah and Jim. And I think for me, what comes up around having a disability there's a long history of controversy around chronic fatigue syndrome in our culture, in the sense that is it real? Is it in the mind? Is it psychological? And I think similar to looking fine on the outside, there are so many internal systems in my body that are affected on a daily basis and that throughout time have gone through different levels of symptoms and pain and disruption, that the name is it's an offensive name in a lot of the community. And, you know, I know there's a movement in the UK to call it myalgic encephalomyelitis. There was another movement to call it chronic fatigue immune dysfunction syndrome. So it's this way where, because its cause is mysterious, I'm sure that one day when we have a medical breakthrough and we figure out what causes it, we'll maybe name it after the doctor that figures it out, like Lou Gehrig's disease.
And how does that affect your experience with it?
Yeah, I think for me it's a balancing act of, do I tell people, do I not tell people? When I tell people, there's, you know, a questioning of like, but you look so good, but how can you be tired? I think there's so much more to my daily experience of my body than just fatigue. Fatigue is certainly a part of it.
Talk about that.
But I have symptoms. For example, I've struggled with chronic sore throat. Like, we're talking like really painful sore throat. Tender lymph nodes in my neck, under my arms, in my groin, chronic disruption of digestion, which I won't get into details,
that's
but enough. We can talk about, like, I mean, like, really disruptive to a daily functioning. Like, mm-hmm. We don't want to leave the house with some of these symptoms. Nervous system issues. I've had seizures. I've had tremors. I've had unexplained fevers. I've had, you know, a whole litany, rashes, hives, itchy hands and feet, bizarre physical things that don't seem to be linked to anything, until I found a doctor, a PhD MD doctor with a background in infectious diseases out of Stanford, who was the first doctor that sent me for the women drawing my blood said, are you in a study? And I said, no. But I came back with, you know, 22 pages worth of blood work and clear biomarkers from this particular person looking for very specific things that indicated, yes, there's something physical going on, hormonal imbalances, et cetera.
Now, so this is probably the most syndrome that illustrates this best, because not only do you have something that people do not see and that you have to explain to people and people think you're healthy, but you have a medical establishment that maybe doesn't believe in what you have.
Right.
And so you don't necessarily – there are a lot of people who are in your situation and you have that support. But there is – it must feel isolating.
It can, absolutely. And I think the cognitive dissonance for people between what they see – it reminds of Leah's story, what they see versus what's really happening is so different that they can't believe that it's happening. And I've also sat in the seat for people with disabilities because my heart is racing 3,000 beats per minute and I'm afraid that I'm going to collapse in a public space. And I've gotten these dirty looks like, you, what are you doing taking that seat? And I just want to say, oh, this seat is saving me right now. You know, this thing, like, if I didn't have the ability to sit here, this could be bad, and nobody here wants that. Nobody wants me to collapse, I don't think.
And you feel a lack of sympathy. It sounds like everyone has felt a lack of sympathy. Is it a lack of understanding or a lack of – you're very young as well.
Yeah.
It's hard for people who look so young.
Sure. I think absolutely it is. I think once people have had repeated contact with me and they approach me with a sense of humility about my experience and they want to understand, I feel like they've been very – they can really come around to be understanding. But jumping that gap has been the challenge.
We're talking about invisible disabilities. And if you'd like to join the discussion, give us a call at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Or you can email forum@kqed.org. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Judy Campbell in today for Michael Krasny as part of our In My Experience series, highlighting the personal stories of Northern Californians. We're talking with people with invisible disabilities. We're speaking with Leah Sate, who has Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, which affects her joints and mobility. Jim Vos with spinal stenosis and chronic pain. Arielle, a wrestler with chronic fatigue syndrome, and we'll soon talk to Sarah Schaefer, who has Sjogren's syndrome. Arielle, a bit more from you. This was a big change in your life. You similar to Jim. You went.
I was the Energizer Bunny. I was known for this in all of my circles as the person with the most energy in the room at any one given time.
And so now, without visible signs, when your life changes so dramatically, how do you negotiate that? What happens with your relationships with friends, with work,
sure.
with what you do during a day?
Very similar to Jim. I left work on a leave thinking that I would fix it, that I would be the ideal patient. I would find out what was wrong, and then I would do the things I needed to do to get better, and then I would just go right back. And it was clear that it was going to take a lot longer than that. And in fact, that it was something chronic that I was going to live with for the rest of my life. And, you know, it all started with a faded flu that how could I know that it would then lead to this massive life change. And so it was a huge negotiation for me in my personal relationship with my partner. Here we were young, we had moved to California, we had these expectations.
How old were you?
I was 23 when okay. I first got sick. But it took me a few years in the, you know, in the world and in the grind to really figure out that I needed to, regardless of the doctors telling me you're allergic to the fog or you're, you know, not used to California germs. You know, like I finally said, no, there's something here. And so, you know, we expected to hike and snowboard in Tahoe and do all these things that reflected the life that we had planned to have. But the reality was that life had changed, and I was so ill at the nadir, thank you, of my illness that it was like, what is this? Are you going to stay with me? Are we going to be able to make this work? You know, and the answer was yes, and I was lucky. I was a lucky one. A lot of people I knew lost their partnerships. I did lose friendships. You know, my life had changed in such a way that sitting with a friend and talking about her most recent wine tasting experience or her excursions to the woods and my talking about the diet that I'm trying and the medicine protocol and the most recent horrifying experience I had at the doctor. I mean, her eyes would just glaze over and do these fantastic Mr. Fox black and white spirals to me. And similar for me, it was – I didn't want to hear about her amazing adventures that just made me feel terrible about what I couldn't do. So – it took a long time and a long process to integrate that this was the new reality, and how could I adjust to this reality and create a world or a life for myself that felt like a living, felt like I was here and that I had something to do here, even if what I thought I was put here to do was different.
Sarah Schaefer, that we've been listening to Arielle, wrestler who has chronic fatigue syndrome. And Sarah Schaefer has Sjogren's syndrome. Sarah Schaefer, for 18 years, was a public health physician for the city of San Francisco and Contra Costa County and has been on disability. Sarah, thanks so much for joining.
Thank you.
I wonder, does this what you've been hearing so far ring a bell with you?
Everything rings true amazingly. I mean, the whole experience of leaving work, having a very traumatic unraveling of my health, which for me happened at the age of 44, which was 11 years ago. I went from being an athletic practicing physician with two school-age kids to mostly bedridden. Mm-hmm. And my symptoms are very similar to Arielle's with profound fatigue, and I think she'll relate to this. My fatigue is not tired. It's not improved by rest. It's like being your cells are soaking in a toxic marinade.
And do you find the fatigue that people maybe don't understand fatigue? Everybody's
totally.
Fatigued. It doesn't cause a
right. Everybody's tired. It's like saying to Jim, everyone has back pain. It is not normal fatigue. It is just unnegotiable. Cannot continue moving. Cannot do normal things. And there's a kickback that, just like people with chronic fatigue syndrome, if I do too much or go outside mm-hmm. the box, mm-hmm. I can pay for days or even weeks with a flare of my illness, mm-hmm. you know, which is, you know, very similar to chronic fatigue syndrome with muscle pain and achiness all over, gastrointestinal symptoms, just incredible, profound feeling of illness all over my body. I mean, I have a thousand things I could tell you that I have, but those are the main.
And it's an autoimmune disease. It's similar to lupus. Is that
it's
right?
It's the closest cousin is lupus, but I like to call it the most common disease no one's ever heard of because it's extremely common. About 1% of the adult population has this, which is amazing. That's about 4 million people in the United States. It's mostly women, and it's similar to lupus and RA where the immune system makes a mistake and attacks normal cells in your body. And for us, we're called the dry disease because the hallmark signs are dry eyes and dry mouth, which almost everyone, but not 100% of people have. But it's a systemic inflammatory disease that causes systemic symptoms that can affect almost any part of the body, and disabling fatigue and muscle and joint pain are quite typical.
Now, you had this for a long, you had symptoms for a long time before knowing what you had, and you were a doctor.
Yes. A delay in diagnosis is classic. It took 7 years to confirm my diagnosis, even though I was so sick I could barely get out of bed. I was very, very fortunate to have a rheumatologist who took me quite seriously and treated me based on symptoms. But it took a year of being so sick and bedridden before I even had a clue what was going on. And I was the one that figured out that I had Sjogren's, asked for the referral to the rheumatologist, and said, I think I have Sjogren's. And he thought, well, maybe, maybe not. But at least he was willing to take me seriously and treat me, which is not true for many people with Sjogren's. Many people with Sjogren's don't get that kind of care. They get dismissed as malingering. Most of us are women, so it's like, oh, you're menopausal, that kind of thing. So we're not just invisible to society like the chronic fatigue syndrome people. We're really invisible to our medical providers, too, because many of them do not understand the spectrum of our disease, and they're not trained to recognize it, which is pretty crazy considering how common it is.
Well, and you were one of these people, not necessarily fitting the mold that you're discussing there, but how has it changed? Being a doctor and going through this experience, what kind of insight has it given you into medicine?
Well, I do a lot of advocacy now for Sjogren's, and the Sjogren's Syndrome Foundation is fantastic. It's www.sjogrens.org. You can put that on your website. They're the best source of information out there. But I feel like being a doctor, I almost feel like I have this moral need to advocate for Sjogren's syndrome and to help people that have it and to explain to other professionals what it's about, because it's so under the radar for people. And people don't get good care a lot of the time, and they're not taken seriously because there's this strange misbelief or miseducation that it's just all about being dry. And I don't think not being able to work, sometimes being in bed 16 to 20 hours a day, is not a benign all-about-dry disease. It's really, really serious.
Now, I wonder how you feel and how all of you feel about, it sounds like you feel a responsibility to the disease, that you are an ambassador to talk about what life is like with this, and you're all here talking publicly about it. But is there a divide with you at all? Are you conflicted about, there are people, I think it causes you some problems. There are people who are unsympathetic because they can't see your disease. They can't see your disability. But people who are in a wheelchair don't have the choice, or many other disabilities, people don't have the choice to pass live a normal life if they don't want to tell people. It is noticed, and people may react differently. How do you all feel? Is passing something you want to do? Is it something that you think is a burden? Leah, say it.
It's kind of a tricky question because there's definitely a part of me that just really wishes I was like everyone else, that I didn't have to deal with this, because it's not easy. I mean, as much as I appreciate the perspective it's given me in terms of my priorities and knowing what's important to me and who's important to me, it's really hard to live with. And there are times that I wish I didn't have to live with it and that I could be like everyone else. So those times, passing is nice. If I'm out at a friend's party and I'm meeting new people, it's nice for them to think of me as just a new person they're meeting and not a new person with a disability. But it almost always comes up.
Is it hard to know when to bring it up?
Yeah, I think absolutely. I mean, I completely agree with that.
Mario wrestler.
I completely agree with what Leah said. I think for me, as a person who has a spiritual orientation, my spiritual energy is one that has increased as a result of the physical drains that have happened in my body. And so it doesn't, because I feel often stuck on the plane of trying to explain and be validated and understood and seen, I can't really get to the meat of what I think has changed my life positively about it. So that's a challenge. So in terms of passing, it's like sometimes, it's just like Leah, it feels good to just be there and seem normal, even though there's also a feeling of of a being in and also out of that exchange with someone, that I'm somehow always separate from wherever their reality is, though I don't know. It's taught me a humility towards what I don't know.
Jimbo?
I see it maybe there's some parallels to this with a tremendous sense of loss that you might have in any part of life. I think you go through the same kind of feelings that, you know, like losing a loved one, you might even see the parallels there where you know, you're wrestling with what's important, you're redefining meaning, you're maybe looking for your religious values or your view of the world more broadly. So it certainly, you know, parallels those kind of experiences. But in terms of being an advocate, I probably am more prone not to talk about it just because of people don't want to hear about pain. They, you know, they think you're complaining. You know, you're kind of, you're certainly not the life of the party if you bring up pain and, you know, try to explain to people why you can't do something. So in that sense, it's very isolating, because you kind of have to live with it, and you still have to deal with the people around you and kind of deal with society's view of the world. And usually it's too long to explain, so I kind of leave it to myself.
Sarah Schaefer, you have found it isolating as well.
Yes. And I too have lost a lot of friendships because of it. But I think one of the things that's very important to me is to be able to be real with the people who are closest with me, mm-hmm. which doesn't mean focusing on it or complaining about my symptoms, but for them to understand my limitations and understand my struggle and the general territory that I'm feeling with and that I'm dealing with, excuse me. So that to me is really important, and that's balanced with not wanting to focus too much on being sick and having mm-hmm. broad interests in life. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, there's the practical thing of, you know, if I can't stand for more than 15 to 30 minutes because of my illness, and I have a dysautonomia with it, which I didn't mention, so I get dizzy and I want to pass out if I stand too long. So it's, you know, there's some very, very practical things, and that leaves out of a lot of things that I can do in life. So, you know, I also have incredible fragrance sensitivity, and so if people come over wearing fragrances, it can send me down the tubes for days. And for people to understand that and just to be able to state my needs and my limitations in a very real and grounded way without judgment of them or me, but I have to take care of myself.
There's a lot of morality around illness, isn't there? People make a lot of judgments about people who aren't able, especially if they're young and look healthy, who aren't able to pull themselves together.
I feel, for me, there's a huge, I've been ill for over 11 years now, and I am very interested in the process that you go through when you're ill. And one of the things that's underlying illness that is often subconscious, but there's a tremendous amount of shame, both coming from the culture, but coming from within. There's often this feeling of, why can't I figure this out? Why can't I make this manageable? Even if you can't cure your disease, can you make yourself much more functional and more healthy? And I actually have made some good headway on some of my symptoms, but I'm still not able to work or do many, many normal things. And I no longer feel much of that shame, but that took a lot of work and spiritual practice. Also, mm-hmm. you know, meditation and that type of thing.
And do you think that's that experience is worse for people who have invisible disabilities?
What experience?
Oh, the experience of the shame. And do you think that is different for people, maybe?
I think that's a really, really complicated question, and mm-hmm. it depends on the individual and
sure.
their condition.
You know,
someone who smokes and has lung cancer might feel really like, oh, my gosh, I did this to myself. So I don't know. I think it's a really, really complicated question.
We're going to hear from some listeners. Marlena is in Petaluma. Thanks for joining, Marlena.
Hi, thank you. The primary thing I wanted to say is I'm 62. Every single thing that I have heard from everybody on your panel is exactly my experience. I was a chef. I was a cowgirl. I worked in construction. I had a very active life. I was athletic as a kid. And in my late 40s, I developed a whole bunch of things. I had spinal damage. I have fibromyalgia. I have chronic fatigue. It's a list that's long. It's invisible. Everyone who looks at me can't believe at 62 that I look this good. And the truth is, it's only because of genetics. It's not because of how hard my life has been. But the primary thing I wanted to say is a component of dealing with this is grief, because you've lost the life you once had. So for me, not only accepting it, being in therapy was critical, developing a spiritual life was critical, but also grieving the loss of everything you could do is really important. And I just can't emphasize that enough.
Now, a lot of you have talked about coming to peace in certain ways. It has focused your lives. It has made you define what is important to you. I think in talking before the show, many of you have seen it as a gift. Jim Vos, I don't know if you would define it that way.
I think there's certainly aspects of it that have been beneficial, in the sense that I've taken the time to see the world around me. When you're going 80 miles an hour, things fly by. But when you're at zero, you can look around and see things that you've never noticed before. So, you know, that's been helpful to me in some sense. I've certainly been able to find a new part of myself in becoming maybe a more active father. I truly enjoy raising my daughter, and it's the most important job that I have. So in that sense, yeah, I'd say there's been some benefits.
Arielle Ressler, you mentioned the difficulty in having conversations when you have such a gulf between your friends or telling you the things they're doing that you can't do, mm-hmm. and they don't necessarily want to hear the details of what has been going on with your health. I wonder how do you all feel about what do you want to hear from people? Do you want? I think one thing that a lot of people mention is that people sort of think you don't see it, so you kind of think it's going to go away. You don't necessarily think that years on, the person will be dealing with the same thing. Do you want to be asked how do you feel? Is that something you want people to honestly ask you during the day? Would you rather talk about it, not talk about it? Leah, say.
I'd rather people not ask me how I feel, because I get kind of tired hearing myself say, you know, in pain, not great. Right. It gets old, and the answer is never going to be fine, truthfully. It's not. It's because that's the nature of chronic pain. I think the thing that I would like to hear the most from people is, I believe you. Mm. You know, I believe that you have this. I believe that your pain is real, that you're not making this up.
And is that one of your main experience? Is that a common experience that you feel skepticism when you talk to people?
Oh, absolutely. I don't think that people give me the benefit of the doubt. I've had people see me use the handicap parking placard and either directly accuse me of not needing it, or people have made snide comments kind of jokingly. People I know have said, jokingly suggested that maybe I borrowed it from a relative or something, and then I have to explain, no, I deserve this. This is mine. The DMV does not make it easy to get this. This is something that I need, and I don't think the benefit of the doubt is something that I get.
You all have had these kinds of experiences, haven't you, mm-hmm. of being do you have a mixed reaction to that? I mean, what do you think? I think the people that are doing this would say, well, we just want to make sure people aren't, you know, scamming the system. These are supposed to be for disabled people.
I've kind of become a placard guard in some sense. I guess when I see people that park in disabled spots and I don't see a visible placard, I'll approach them and I'll ask them, oh, did you forget to put your placard up? And if they don't have a placard, then I'll ask them to leave the spot. So that's been different.
I think that's probably the best way to do it. I I take a more passive-aggressive approach personally. I take a picture of the car with the license plate and I put it on my blog, which is probably pretty terrible. But I think I have some issues approaching people. I'm really scared of backlash, of, you know, going up to someone and them being rude to me. Because I know that when someone approaches me, I am sometimes ready to be rude to them if they make these assumptions.
Sure. Sarah, do you want to weigh in, Sarah?
Yeah, I do. I actually, it's a little bit different, but I think when you asked about people asking and talking about how they can be supportive, I think one of the main things is to be willing to adapt to your friend's physical limitations instead of expecting to be able to do the old things you could do. Ask, you know, what can we do together that works for you and fitting into your new life? And that shows attention and love and kindness. And, you know, if we have specific health needs, like my chemical sensitivity need, don't take that as a personal front. Just don't wear your scented products. And I feel like that alone would just really, really help improve the quality of life for many people that have invisible disability, is to have people who really put out the effort to fit into your limitations so that you don't get as socially isolated, is often the case for many of us.
Mary writes, thanks for running this program. My heart goes out to your guests. I'm in my mid-50s and have multiple sclerosis. Most people think I look great, and that's what they tell me. My main symptom is numbness in my feet. This causes me to be off balance and requires I use a cane. I've been asked by sneering, angry people, why are you using that cane? My reaction has been to meekly answer this question. Actually, I've been thinking I will be more direct and call them out for the rudeness. Conversely, I've had people on the street ask me what's wrong with concern and sympathy, and do I have MS? They've engaged me in conversation, wished me well. I will remember those people and keep moving forward. Rosie writes, I've been struggling with chronic fatigue, fibromyalgia, sleep apnea, pain, etc. since an auto accident in 1989. I've not worked since 1994. One thing I'd like to hear discussed is the shame inherent in our go-go culture, heaped upon people who cannot work and be productive. We are not a very caring, kind society. And we can discuss that, and also a question that comes from Crystal. I was diagnosed with primary Sjogren's 2 years ago and have both before and since experienced other symptoms such as chronic fatigue, frequent colds, food sensitivity, and joint pain. All of these symptoms have prevented me from working an adequate schedule. I'm wondering how those on the panel have disclosed their disabilities to their employers and what would be a great resource in understanding my rights. Arielle Ressler, would you like to take that up?
Sure. I'm on disability.
And you haven't been working.
I succeeded in winning my case. I was severely disabled at the time that I won my case. I think, though, that what comes up is the idea of getting review, you know, where and in the course of chronic fatigue syndrome, the severity can fluctuate. So there's good periods and bad periods, and people talk about this. I think managing the good periods with people is the hardest because they say, hey, but wait a minute, weren't you so? And so for me, if I don't take a certain number of steps every day and sleep a certain number of hours and follow all of these, then I will quickly deteriorate back down and unravel into very severe disability. So I'm in this line of, can I hold on to my disability? Will it, you know, where it's so black and white, you know, that's been a challenge.
And Leah, say, you are the one on the panel who is still working.
Yes.
Yeah. And how have you dealt with this at work? Did you disclose?
It was a hard conversation to have, but after a couple of weeks of working, I, you know, set up a meeting with my manager and explained to her, you know, I have this syndrome. At the time, I didn't have the diagnosis, so I just explained my symptoms and that I had something called hypermobility. And she was understanding about it, but it's hard. My job is long hours. It's a lot of going to events. It's a lot of networking. It's a lot of standing up. There are times that, again, I think one of the questions was pushing yourself and shame in a really go-go culture. Mm-hmm. There are times that I do push myself, mm-hmm. and I have come home at the end of a long day, opened my door, and collapsed in the doorway, and just not been able to move for the next few hours. It's been hard. But disclosing that to my employer, I think, was really important, having that conversation with my manager. And I'm lucky that my job and my manager are really understanding. My manager's really flexible about me needing to work from home some days. I have a long commute, so there are days that I'm in pain, and I'll call her in the morning and say, I'm not comfortable being behind the wheel. My ankle's loose. I'm not going to drive today. And luckily, a lot of my job can be done remotely.
David in Sebastopol, please join us. We're short on time, so if you could make your comment short.
I was 54 years old when I was involved in a car accident, and I had an injury to my sciatic nerve. It was not visible, but I had to give up my practice doing anesthesia for cardiac and transplant surgery. The problem I had was it took over a year to find a specialist who could figure out what was going on because there was no external evidence of what was wrong. And what I would like to add to the discussion is, first of all, that you have to become your own advocate and keep looking if you don't get the answers. And because I find that even as a physician, many physicians are just looking for a routine diagnosis. And when they can't find the sort of cookbook answer to your problem, they just dismiss you. You need to find a physician who's going to keep working as your advocate to keep looking until you get the answers to what's wrong with you.
All right, David, thank you so much for joining the program, and that's all the time we have. I want to thank Jim Vos, Ariel Ressler, Leah Seth, and Sarah Schaefer for joining the program. I'm Judy Campbell in for Michael Krasny. Our producers are Katie Springer, Tina Lauerberg, and Irene Noguchi. Senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Thanks so much for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.